Well, good morning. It is Thursday, and that means once again, time for Perspectives on WFSU-FM. I'm Tom Flanagan. Thank you so much for joining us via radio waves and telephone lines and email machines and Twitter devices and all the other ways we have to communicate. 414-1234 is the phone number if you'd like to be part of the action this morning. Long distance is 800-926-8809. Perspectives at WFSU.org is the email, and our Twitter account is at WFSU Perspective. You know, as rivers go, the Apalachicola would kind of seem to be a fairly minor waterway. It's only about 112 miles in length within the state of Florida, although its furthest headstream is way up in northeast Georgia, right up there in the corner, which makes it a total distance of about 500 miles, which is pretty good. But when it comes to biological diversity, here's where we really go crazy, because there are few river basins in the world that can compare to the Apalachicolas, because you have the plants and the bees that produce Tupelo honey, for instance, and those legendary oysters in the bay, and a gigantic catalog of plant and animal species within the river's basin. And then there's the recreational resource, which is the Apalachicola, and so many other aspects of this particular body of water. And we're going to talk about as many of them as we can fit into the next 52-odd minutes here this morning on Perspectives. We have a fantastic panel of folks who know and love the river, and we're going to talk about it all as we meet. First, Kim Sash, conservation biologist who specializes in reptiles and amphibians and free-range chickens and a whole bunch of other things. She is at Tall Timbers Research Station and Land Conservancy and very familiar with the Apalachicola National Forest, various habitats and species. And Kim, it is great to have you here.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
Right next door is George Ackerman, who is a volunteer coordinator of the Apalachicola River Trek that launches October 11th. And what, since 2012 you've been doing that, I think, Georgia?
Yeah, Doug and I have been partnering since 2012 on this. We've both been down the river multiple times, so it's a tremendous honor for us to work with a new group. Every year we have returning members and new members, and it's just a ton of fun to get out on the water with them and help them experience the river firsthand. Great fun.
Well, you mentioned your paddle partner in crime there, Doug Alderson, who's right across from there. Doug, it's always good to see you again,
sir. Great to be here. This will be my fourth river trek that I've paddled the entire river, and I never tire of it. It's just a wonderful way to see the river and to expose new people to it.
Well, we also have joining us on the phone from his hometown of Pensacola, Jim McClellan, who serves on the board of Apalachicola Riverkeeper. And thanks so much for joining us, Jim.
Well, thanks for having me. And let me be clear, though. Pensacola is where I live. My hometown is Bluntstown, right on the bank of the Apalachicola River.
Beautiful Bluntstown, we should say, huh?
The greater metropolitan Bluntstown area.
Well, Jim, thank you so much for joining us via phone. We want to find out more about Riverkeeper. But while we're talking about Riverkeeper, that brings us to Dan Tonsmere, who's Apalachicola Riverkeeper and also the keeper of a voluminous amount of documentation here that you've already been working on, Dan. So it's great to see you again, sir.
Thank you, Tom. It's always good to be here with you. And I just get excited every year about River Trek. It is just the most fun.
Before we get into the trek, though, since you are the guy with the facts and the figures and the this gigantic notebook here, what is the current status of the Apalachicola? And we'll get into the interstate water wars and all that, certainly. But right now, snapshot in time, what's going up with the river?
Not good times, Tom. We're right now back down at 5,000 CFS, and we'll be there, it sounds like, for the foreseeable future throughout the fall. The salinities in the bay are high. Our oyster production is down lower than it was last year. In general, the ecosystem is not doing well because of the lack of water.
Okay, and that 5,000 CFS, which is cubic feet per second.
Yeah,
right?
I always forget that. That's the volume of water going past, going down the river. And that is a minimum that the Corps of Engineers can release until we go into drought operations. So they're hitting the very bottom of their required release to the Apalachicola.
Ideally, what should it be?
Well, in pre-development times, we were seeing more like 10 to 12,000 CFS cubic feet per second, so almost double what we have now. That's reduced to a great extent by what Georgia is withdrawing out of the system and some evaporation out of the reservoirs.
And before we get into the impact, not only in the oysters in the Apalachicola Bay, which require that very delicate balance of salt water and fresh water so that adequate river flow is essential to what they're doing. If we go out to Bluntstown there, Jim McClellan, what's the situation there with that low water flow for the communities like Bluntstown that are along the river there? Does it have any real impact on them, or do they just look out and say, oh, river's down, big deal?
Well, I've talked to people in their, you know, their 60s, 70s, 80s, and even 90s, and over the last 10 years or so, what I'm hearing from the folks over there is that they've never seen it be down this low for this long. It's worrisome to everyone there. You know, most of the people in Bluntstown and the surrounding areas hunt, fish, spend a lot of time in the woods and on the river, and it's very disturbing to them to see cypress trees hundreds of feet from the water, to see dry land where they're accustomed to catching fish, and to know that the river is in deep trouble.
That water basin, of course, as we mentioned at the beginning of the program, is a major driver of all the biological diversity. And Kim Sash, we can throw that over to you. What does that low level mean as far as the animal and the plant life throughout the basin?
Yeah, I mean, there's a huge biodiversity of reptiles and amphibians that rely on this basin, and a lot of turtles. We've got an endemic Barber's Map turtle that lives nowhere else in the world that relies on the river, and it eats mussels, so those mussels need to have good water quality in order for them to survive. The alligator snapping turtle is also only found, it's now the Apalachicola alligator snapping turtle, so it's not found anywhere else either. And then there's a whole host of amphibians that also need water, and what's crucial to them is this floodplain. And if this floodplain isn't allowed to flood and fill some of these seasonal wetlands, those animals don't have anywhere to breed. So good flows are critical for a lot of those species.
Yeah, it sounds like what happened with the Nile River Basin, if we want to go back, that is where ancient Egypt, of course, got its actual driver of civilization, was the periodic flooding of the plain of the Nile, which allowed people to plant agricultural crops and things like that. And you're saying the same thing kind of holds true with the Apalachicola.
Definitely. Yeah, that floodplain is critical. And it flooding on occasion is critical. So we need water, yeah.
All right. And for things like recreation as well. So, and Doug and Georgia, since you guys are doing the kayaking thing here coming up on October 11th, will you have enough water to make it from Chattahoochee down to the bay?
We may hit a couple sandbars, but we will have enough water. For kayaking, you don't need too much water. We'll go a little slower than normal. There'll be a lot of sandbars to stop at for swims and so forth. So recreation-wise, for kayaking, it's not too problematic. Obviously, we want to see the quality of the river improve, and so that's part of the reason we'll have speakers and different folks educating the paddlers every night on the river.
So it's not just paddling then, Georgie?
There is no better way to learn about the Apalachicola River and Bay other than to plunge in and experience it firsthand, and even if you've done it multiple times, you'll go out every single time, and I guarantee you'll be re-energized and recommitted to wanting to protect it, and you'll learn at least 5 new things. The paddlers do get to meet with some dynamic speakers every day. We've got folks like Harley Means and Pearson Hill and Todd Engstrom, Michael Hill, some Toria Rangers coming out to speak with the group. So they're going to be working hard every day. They're paddling 22, 23 miles at low flows. Don't let Doug fool you guys. You're going to be feeling it at the end of the night. But yep. They'll be meeting with speakers along the way and get energized and get an opportunity to ask questions and learn both from experiencing the river as well as talking to the experts.
It's like open-air seminars you
guys
are having
all the time. Around a campfire.
It's like a fall camp, except it's along a, what, how many miles? It's all 112?
If they go in a straight exact line after we launch in Chattahoochee, we tell them it's 107. I got into a little trouble last week because I said 110 and there was a mere mutiny. What do you mean 110? You said 107. These folks have been working hard all summer long. They apply early in the spring to be on the team. They go through this application process. They promise to raise money. They join the team. They jump out there. They're in their communities. They're talking to people, folks like Kim, she's got over 70 sponsors. So she, like, if you see her in Publix, look out. She'll be asking you. Jim McClellan, too. Jim did this last year. Jim is not a shy man. He will ask everybody. But it's all for the protection and conservation of this critical river and bay. And that's why they're doing it. And that's why they get to go play for a week and have a great time.
And Dan Townsend, that is a wonderful segue into exactly what the Apalachicola River Keeper does as far as preserving, protecting, defending that water resource. And how do you guys do that?
Primarily, we advocate for the protection of the river, you know, we have multiple ways that we do that, primarily education or developing some science approaches or projects that we participate in. To a great degree, we are in a legacy of individuals and people that have worked on the river system. You have scientists like Skip Livingston and Helen Light that have really spent careers developing information so we know what we really have out there and the uniqueness and importance and significance of it. We have politicians both local and state like Bobby Howell that was clerk of the court in Apalachicola for many years, and Senator Bob Graham, Governor Senator Bob Graham, who is still working to try to help us protect it. The agency leaders, Gail Carmody and Bill McCartney, that spent thousands of hours and time buying land or protecting the Apalachicola, Estes Whitfield, Duncan Cairns, people that in their whole agency life work to help protect the Apalachicola, and then the local citizens, Don Ashley, Dave McClain, people that really have made extraordinary efforts to protect the system. And where River Trek is coming in now, we're kind of at the crux of where we can actually turn this thing around to protect the Apalachicola.
That sounds like a situation we can talk about in greater detail on the other side of this upcoming break, which is bearing down on us. If you would like to join the conversation as we discuss the Apalachicola River and the upcoming River Trek, 414-1234, the local number, 800-926-8809. We'll be right back. The Apalachicola River, which is the pinnacle of waterways for this area of Florida and also a portion of Alabama and also up through Georgia. It is not just a Florida resource, and therein lies a bit of the challenge here, Dan Townsmere, as we talk about the perennial problem of ensuring that everyone along the Apalachicola gets at least some kind of fair distribution of the water resource that is there, and why can't we figure this out?
It has been three decades now, Tom, that struggle has been going on. And even before then, there were efforts to try to look at how you manage this whole ACF system, the Apalachicola-Chattahoochee-Flint system. I talked a little bit about the legacy that Florida has had in trying to protect this system, both from studying it, from buying land, from implementing policies and planning efforts that we properly manage the system so that it will sustain itself. Georgia's legacy is not quite so bright. You know, they have a well-oiled political machine that is really backed by some national corporations that refuse to accept their role in the protection of this nationally significant ecosystem. There have been numerous efforts along this three-decade process, if you want to call it that, of trying to work this out. And I think nobody has tried harder than Apalachicola Riverkeeper has to try to come together and collaborate. But by denying their influence on the system, that is been just impossible to overcome. And they are united in a solid front. They stop legislation. They stop the release of science. They don't allow the Corps to go in and look at the way that the releases from the system could be changed. Just all in an effort to hold all that water back in Georgia for Georgia's benefit. And it is it's a recalcitrant attitude that I honestly did everything I could possibly do to go with the olive leaf and say, let's try to work this out together, but they are not willing.
I know there have been summits featuring the governors of Florida and Alabama and Georgia. There have been initiatives in Congress. There have been multiple lawsuits. There have been all kinds of different initiatives over the years that have come forward to try to get this situation resolved. So where are we right now, today, as we sit?
Okay, we have two really, these are the biggest decisions that have ever been made in terms of the future of the Apalachicola system. We have the Florida versus Georgia lawsuit in the Supreme Court. And Florida has asked the Supreme Court to make a water allocation to have equitable use of the water in the ACF system, because what has happened to us, we're getting so little now that our ecosystem and our economy is collapsing. Our economy is based on a healthy ecosystem because of the fishing and the timber harvesting and all that. So the special master has the job of making a recommendation after hearing 4 to 6 weeks of trial. It's going to start October the 31st. He's actually hearing from the two states. He's accepting amicus briefs, which we're submitting one of those, and he will make a recommendation to the full court. So say the trial ends sometime in early mid-December. Maybe he makes his recommendation sometime in January, February, and then the court has to decide what they will do with it. So that decision will be final. It is not something we can go back and change. And if he decides that he is going to look at the ecosystem needs in Apalachicola, it will be a tremendous change to the way the system has been managed. And in doing so, he will have to put the brakes on Georgia's water use, which is depleting the system. And hopefully he is going to set that back to a quantity that will allow the Apalachicola system to be sustained.
Okay, but should, and let's get Jim McClellan in on this conversation too. Jim, if it would come down on the other side that possession is 9/10 of the law, and essentially Georgia is in possession of the faucet on this particular sink, what then? Does the Apalachicola go to the way of the Colorado out in the west, and by the time it gets to Apalachicola Bay, there's essentially nothing left?
Well, certainly, you know, we hope that that is not the case. Hopefully, I was just thinking about this. These problems are very complex in nature. They require engineers to solve. They require a lot of negotiations. But, you know, the truth of the matter is a group of five-year-olds could get to the heart of the problem, and that's the, you know, we have to share the water.
Share the water.
And all we can hope for in this process is that someone will look at it and say, this is wrong. We can't corral all the water in Georgia and kill off the Apalachicola River, the floodplain, and the bay. So I don't like to think about what might happen if we don't win.
Yeah, because no one else has been able to work this out just over low these many years. But this again is part of the trek process here. I kind of wish there were a Georgia river trek so that folks could...
Well, I think Jim's point is really well taken, and there are a lot of big picture people, and there have been stakeholder attempts that have put forth a water sharing plan. That Apalachicola Chattahoochee Flint Stakeholders Group did that precisely and said, hey, here's the plan. We've been working on this for a long time, and I would like, it would have been great if our policymakers would have picked that up and ran with it. But there are people that understand, people in Alabama, Georgia, and Florida, and throughout the region that understand we need to protect this entire river system, and we can indeed share the water, and it's critical for everybody's health. You know, Apalachicola River Keeper has a lot of supporters in the Georgia area. In fact, we've got two of our paddlers from RiverTrack this year are live in Georgia, and they're also supporters and members of the other two Riverkeeper groups within the system. So there's a lot of people that get it and believe that we can share. And I'm hoping that the Supreme Court says the same thing.
Yeah, but historically there had been, as you had said, Dan, even greater flows in the Apalachicola. Is it just because we are in a cyclical regional drought situation now, and where every drop of water becomes even more critical than before? Or if we had adequate rainfall within the basin, would this become a moot point because there's plenty of water for everyone?
The science that I've seen doesn't show that, Tom, is that, yes, we're in drier periods, and droughts are a naturally recurring event, and we're in a drier period, yes. But what we're experiencing now is our droughts are so much drier, or the flows are so much lower and for much longer periods of time. Before the development in the basin, 5,000 CFS was seen a very few times, but it was still, we hit 5,000 CFS, but it might have been for a day or two, and then the river popped back up. Now we're seeing 5,000 CFS for 8, 9, 12 months at a time during a, you know, drought's a stressful time, yes, but when you add to the severity of it and extend it, you're pushing your ecosystem beyond a threshold. Skip Livingston defines it as stretching a rubber band. You know, it'll come back if you just stretch it so far, but you take it out beyond that, and the rubber band, you lose the elasticity, and it does not recover.
And the health of the bay is directly correlated to the health and that freshwater flow coming down. So I think it was Rob Diaz de Villegas did a great job in a ecology blog talking about he called it the nutrient soup. So those nutrients are coming down the river, the freshwater flow from that river 110 miles down into that bay, feeding that estuary and all that fantastic, help me here, Kim.
The fantastic 36th biodiversity hotspot in the United States is part of the coastal plain and part of that resource. So that is the biodiversity and the nutrients and the wonderful river are all part of that. So
that's what grows the oysters.
Mm-hmm. And the everything else that is along that river basin, because it doesn't all wind up in Apalachicola Bay. As you said, Kim, there is overflow during the periods when we do have adequate water and a little bit of flooding along that plain, and that keeps everything going too. Right. Even the larger trees, because I hear there's stress now on some of even the larger trees in the Apalachicola Basin.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, and Tupelo honey is an economic driver for Wewahitchka and a bunch of those smaller towns along the river. And so they need Tupelo trees to make their honey, which is delicious. And so it's critical.
So that water that nourishes that floodplain picks up nutrients out of the floodplain, takes them down to the bay, and that is where the nutrients kick off the productivity of the whole bay, not just oysters, but crabs, shrimp, fish.
And we hope to hear from some of the beekeepers in Wewahitchka. That's part of the education process, to see how dependent they are on the water for the floodplain. The floodplain gets to be about 5 miles wide when you get to the bay, so we don't really see that much on the river, so you just have to kind of see an aerial photo to realize that the river we're on is much more narrow than the floodplain.
Yeah, you look at Google Earth, and that is a huge floodplain when you get down towards the bay.
Exactly.
Let's see. Marsh is online, too, to add to the conversation here on Perspectives. Hi, Marsh.
Yes, sir. How y'all doing today?
Hey, we're doing good. Thanks for calling.
This is an idea. It may be a dumb idea, but it may start the juices flowing to come up with something. Why not place 7-inch pipes on all the rivers that feed the Apalachicola and bypass say 1% of the water.
And just aggregate it as you get down there towards the bay, so you kind of recover what was missed, huh?
That's right. You put the pipe in facing north, and gravity feed will transfer the water, put electric valves on it so they can be controlled, and when one has more water than it should have, then we pour water from it. Jim Woodruff Dam, does that feed the Apalachicola?
Yes. Yes, sir.
Why can't we? The dam's on our side. Lake Seminole.
Well, the dam is managed by the Corps of Engineers, and I think what you're suggesting is a very expensive proposition, and what you're, I think, is saying pump water back upriver to Georgia to use, but that really defeats the purpose of keeping the floodplain hydrated. They've actually proposed, you know, putting in a desal plant down in Apalachicola and pumping water up the river. The reality is all of that is extremely expensive, and Marsh, there is enough water to go around. It is just a matter of sharing it and using it more efficiently, stopping the waste, improving the agricultural use, reducing it, making it more efficient. There is going to have to be some serious money spent any way we go in order to conserve enough water to protect the Apalachicola. But pumping water back upriver really is high energy cost. It is probably one of the lower priorities that might work.
Yeah, but perhaps less bang for the buck. But thanks for the idea, Marshall. You got to think out of the box on some of this. And a quick reminder here that you can always find Perspectives online at WFSU.org. Just go to that address, click on radio, pull down the programs menu, and then click Perspectives, because we archive past shows. We try to have the latest program up within a few hours of when it actually airs week by week. So you can go back if you're just tuning in now and hear it in its entirety again and again, ad infinitum, ad nauseum. Very easy to do. So WFSU.org is where you do that. Does it all start with kind of the holdback at Lake Lanier, which my daughter now lives in Atlanta, and we had an opportunity to visit there. And it's a beautiful area, and it's residential, and you got boats and everything else. And it's just to keep the water levels up in Lake Lanier. So that's a recreational resource for Atlanta. Or does there, as some folks in that area have said, a major component of Atlanta's water supply that comes out of Lake Lanier that necessitates them hanging on to a larger chunk of the total flow?
So it's not a one particular thing is the problem. It's the culmination of things. So you start at the top. The ag use is probably 2 to 3 times what Atlanta uses. And during these dry and drought periods, they have to kick the flow, their pumpage up, because they have to keep the crops going. Atlanta, on that other hand, could, if they so chose, to go into drought operations and actually reduce their consumption. So the reservoirs are held higher by the Corps in order to make sure there's enough water up there for Atlanta to keep water moving in the system. And the way they have proposed their change, this is the other big decision that's coming on. The way they've proposed it is they're going to hold water back more to protect drinking water for Atlanta, which is going to increase even further the additional drought, extend the droughts, cause more droughts in the Apalachicola in order to preserve that system. And that's just not acceptable for them to take that role and destroy this ecosystem and play that role in it.
Because essentially, I think what you're saying, Dan, is that with proper and prudent management, there is enough to go around. We may not get everything we want, but we're going to get more than what we got now.
Exactly. They just need to recognize that we need flow. I mean, both Georgia and the Corps have just been in denial in terms of looking at what our needs are, because they claim either we're not the problem, somebody else is, or, you know, we don't need to look at what you need because Congress didn't tell us to. And those two positions are It's really hard to understand.
Yeah, hence, it's winding up in the court and now awaiting the final disposition of this whole thing.
Exactly. And so some of the things we're doing is to, again, this river trek in the long scheme of this 30-year saga, we're right there at the cusp of these two decisions, which are going to cast the fate for the Apalachicola. And this group of adventurers are going to carry this message as far and wide as we can of the importance of the Apalachicola. And they are reaching out to their networks. And what we need is everybody, anybody that has a connection, a chit to call in, whatever, to try to get a better understanding. If you know the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal editor or whatever, the Portland, Maine Gazette, you know, we need to try to get this word out that this is a national issue of significance to everyone in the nation, and we can reverse this trend of degradation of our ecosystems and our river systems across the country.
It's also amazing what happens in today's world of social media, where you get maybe 10 people who know about this who tell 10 more people each about this, and suddenly you have multiple hundreds of thousands of people spreading words like this across the country.
Exactly.
Right. We have 19 participants on River Trek, but those 19 are supported by several hundred people that are donating, and then the word goes out to thousands more through social media and other means, too, in the press. So it reaches out. Part of this is an outreach program beyond the group of River Trekkers to all the supporters and their families and friends.
Will this be live streamed by any chance?
We argue about that every year, quite frankly.
I'm trying to disconnect.
Yeah. So the beauty in my mind is there are some places on the river that are dead zones, which I think is fabulous, but we also do like to share with the community what's going on. So there'll absolutely be some posting of pictures and information sharing, but there'll also be times when we'll invite people to turn their phones off.
Great, and we'll tell you about that when we come back on the other side of the break. We will also add Dan to our conversation, not Dan Townsmere, but another Dan who's lined up here on line two here on WFSU's Perspectives, 414-1234, 800-926-8809. We'll return. When you take a trek down the Apalachicola River, you are immediately transported back to a calmer, gentler, more perhaps antiquated part of our timeline that you don't believe that you are in the year 2016 in many parts of the river. It is just so removed from what we think of as contemporary time, and yet this beautiful, pristine, lovely environment is now at the heart of this interstate war that has been going on for all kinds of time. And Jim McClellan, if we could add you to this conversation here, this is not something that popped up in the past 4 or 5 years. Tell us about how far back this all goes, this dispute over the Apalachicola River and its water resource.
Well, I just sent Georgia a newspaper article from the county, Calhoun County Record from 1964, and my father was among a group of people who actually were upset and concerned enough about the Corps' treatment of the river that they traveled to Washington, D.C. to meet with then-Congressman Don Fuquay and the general in charge of the Corps of Engineers. And my father described that meeting as one that went very well. At the time, the issue was, it was the same issue, just played out a little differently. They would hold water and then release a lot of it. And so the people in Bluntstown that had been, in surrounding areas that had been accustomed to a normal flood cycle of the river were suddenly seeing low flows and then floods. And so they went to meet with the Corps. And that meeting went well. They apparently had the colonel in charge of the Mobile District actually came over to Bluntstown and held a public meeting, and that did not go so well. My father described the outcome of that meeting as the colonel saying, we're the Corps, and we'll do whatever we want. it was an early civics lesson for my father.
I bet it was. But that was even back in the day when there was towboat traffic on the Apalachicola. And that was a major concern as well, because that channel would have to be dredged, and there was some ecological problems with what was left over, the spoils from the bottom of the river, and all kinds of things. And those towboat days are long gone. If you guys have trouble getting kayaks up and down the Apalachicola, can you imagine trying to get a towboat and barges through there right now? Let's bring Dan in. He is patiently waiting on line two. Hi, Dan. Welcome to Perspectives.
Thanks very much for taking up this conversation, Tom. Jim McClellan has a much longer background on perspective on this than do I, but I know that the three-state talks began during the Childs administration, and Governor Childs and previously Senator Childs really was a budget expert, as Jim will also remember, and he understood the difference between fat and grease, that grease was necessary to get an item moved along, that you had to give up something to get something. Well, it seems to me that these talks have made very little progress over the years, because there is no grease. There's no bargaining chips. It's everybody for himself. I need this much water, and I won't compromise, because why should I? I'll just piss off my local residents, and there are not enough benefits. So I was wondering whether there was any benefit to considering actually broadening the scope of these talks, to put some grease in it, to say, what if we agree on free reciprocity on fishing licenses? There are a lot of Georgians that like to fish in Florida, and including on the Apalachicola River. Why don't we treat them as residents? Why don't we put that into the deal? Why don't we talk about establishing wildlife quarters for the benefits of Alabamians and Floridians? You know, this is North Florida and South Alabama. There's a lot of hunting that goes on. Why don't we talk about reciprocity for hunting licenses in certain counties? And those kinds of things that just sweeten the pot. And if people are too focused on self-interest, well, let's broaden the self-interest and see if we can't accomplish anything. This has gone on way too long without very much progress, if any, at all. Thank you. I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you very much, Dan, for the input. Appreciate that. But that's old-fashioned politics, and you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. You may not get everything you want. I won't get everything I want, but we'll meet somewhere in the middle, and we'll each get a little bit, and we'll work this all out. Does that even hold any kind of connection to the contemporary legislative thing that we see? Well, particularly on the federal level, in Congress? Would that work, Dan? Or?
Honestly, I think much of what you are suggesting, maybe not exactly those issues, but much has been offered and suggested. But what has turned up is that Georgia feels like the water that falls in Georgia is their water, and they are unwilling to compromise off of that position. It is very much a recalcitrant position that they feel that the economic development of their state is dependent on being able to have free rein with all of the water, and it's just impossible to and this is the politicians, okay? It's not, I mean, we have members and supporters all over Georgia and Alabama, and they come and visit the Apalachicola, and they understand the significance of it. It is that political situation that has kept it in irons, so to speak, to use a sailing term, for the past 30 years. And despite a lot of effort on many people's parts, it has stuck right here, and that's why we're in the Supreme Court.
And that's the end of the line as far as this is concerned, then.
Correct.
Okay. Happier stuff. Why don't we talk a little bit about what actually takes place on the River Trek for the benefit of those folks who have never been on such an expedition? And that seems almost incomprehensible. What you actually get into little itty bitty teeny tiny boats, and you're not staying at a motel, or and you said there's no Wi-Fi out there, Georgia.
I was going to say, ask Doug and Kim and Jim if their boats are packed yet. How's that going, y'all?
No, it's not packed yet.
Not quite packed.
But I have been practicing. I'm a little nervous, but It'll be fun. It's 20 miles is a pretty good stretch to do for 5 days straight, and I'm a little. The only thing that really scares me is the last bit coming into the bay when it's going to get wavy and windier, and that day five I'm going to be tired and I'm going to have more headwind and it's going to be hard.
Well, I think as a pep talk, you should ask Jim what will be for dinner in Weewa on Thursday exactly. night. Jim, tell us about that.
Well, we are our friend Matthew Godwin, newest board member on the Riverkeeper Board, is going to be doing a fish fry, and we'll have food that actually came from the river. We'll have brim and shell cracker, including Kim the pied brim, P-I-E-D brim, which is, as I understand it, native only to the Apalachicola River system as well. And then we'll have some gator tail and some pulled pork.
Doug and I can attest to, after many river treks, this is the only serious expedition that you can go on and somehow manage to gain weight at the end of it. Taste Buds Catering is doing dinner one night for the group, so the paddlers have to bring all their own lunches and dinners and snacks and water and everything.
Lunches and breakfast, but dinner is usually provided except for the first night.
Correct.
Okay, well, that's an important thing, too, because I think there are many folks who are under the impression that this is just so primitive in its nature that you'd be, you know, going out and, you know, hunting possums or something at night.
Quite like that. We could do that.
But we do camp on sandbars the first three nights. The last night's in a National Forest campground. So we will have pit toilets there, I guess. So that's the difference.
It's pretty extravagant, actually.
But yeah. The river does change every day. The first day is the Big Bluffs, Allen Bluff and Torreya State Park. We get a Stiffanoga Bluff the second day, and we have lots of sandbars through Weewahitchka. We have the Sand Mountain on day four, which is a one that Core created through dredging. It's three stories tall. It's still standing. We can climb up and get a tremendous view. And after that, it gets a little more difficult, not quite as many sandbars. And the last day, as Kim mentioned, is where your training comes in, because a lot of folks are training for this because the tide may be against you, the wind may be against you, the river widens out.
It will be against
and
you.
And so, you know, it's a pretty long day. So that's the first day is probably the easiest because it's the upper part of the river is moving the fastest. The lower part's moving the slowest. So there's a big difference.
I think you hadn't lived till you've seen the full moon come up over Allen Bluff from across the river. It is something to see. And, you know, there's some little treks that we'll take out of the boats as well, looking at some really cool stuff. We'll hike up some dried up sloughs and see what those look like and imagine them when they're in full flow mode. We've been on a hike with Todd to look for the notoriously scarce or extinct.
Presumed extinct, ivory woodpecker. Yeah. And then my favorite part of the trek are all the things that will happen unplanned. We will meet people along the river. We'll meet fishermen and houseboat people and other people that are out exploring. And the connections just become very real when you get to have these experiences that you just didn't know. And the new friendships and storytelling and camaraderie that grows among the group is really exciting. You just have to find out who the snorers are on night one. So on night two, your tent is on the other side
of the sandbar. The sandbars are big enough we can spread the tents out, but Paddling River, I always call it kind of a moving canvas of life because it changes all the time. We see a lot of wildlife, especially early in the morning with deer, and we saw a bear last year, and lots of bald eagles, osprey, wading birds. So it's a beautiful river to paddle along. It's largely undeveloped. Most of it's public land and some private timberland. So it's very undeveloped, very, very scenic.
And when it comes to a biological field trip, Kim Sash, I would imagine as a conservation biologist, this is just going to be heaven for you.
Yeah, I'm really excited just to unplug and enjoy the river. And just you never know what you're going to see out there, so I'm very excited about that.
Well, you mentioned some of the other wildlife, the two-legged variety, and I'm thinking of one of our great writers here in North Florida, Rhett Devane, who hails from Chattahoochee, and she documents a lot of the more, should we say, colorful folk who live along the river, and maybe you'll run into some of those, too, or maybe not. We'll see.
I hope so.
We don't see many boats, so it's not like it's very crowded at all. On the weekend, on Saturday, we might see more people, but the river is largely unpopulated as far as during the week like this.
Well, this is a designated waterway now.
It's a blueway, yes.
Yeah.
But we're having more groups doing the river in kayaks. We're hearing about more small groups that are doing this, and I think that will increase in time.
Yeah, for the future, what does that mean as far as recreation in this part of Florida? Because that is huge for so many people who don't have the availability of a waterway like this to use.
I believe, and I know the folks around the table agree with me, that in terms of conservation, recreation is one of our strongest tools. Whether you're an angler or a hunter or a paddler or a hiker, when you go out and experience these incredibly majestic, remote, and beautiful places, you want to take care of it. So so when folks come out and say, well, where can I go paddle in North Florida? What's there to do? Where should I go? Go check out the Apalachicola. Go experience that. And people are going to come back, and they're kind of blown away by it and feel connected to it. And that's one of the biggest goals of having a group go out and spend 5 days out there and experience the entirety of the river. Mm-hmm. We know that they'll fight to take care of it.
We have several people who have never paddled the river before, never been on the river. So I want to kind of see it through their eyes as they're going down.
And at the same time, try to conserve and protect that the wildness of that area while still making it more attractive to folks who will come and have that same appreciation. So they're not out to, you know, big condo developments along the sandbars, which is, I don't think anyone's looking for
jet skis and motorboats. Yeah, no.
Most of it's protected land in Florida. So we've kind of protected the river at the end of the pipe here. So the idea is to help bring enough water to keep the quality of the river and the bay up. And so that's the big battle.
Okay.
But we protected a lot of the land along the river.
Jim McClellan, we're going to do a quick round robin here as we head into our final moments here on this Perspectives about the Apalachicola. Any final thoughts that you have in encouraging folks to get more involved in the fight to save the Apalachicola, to protect what's there, hopefully to augment the flow or whatever they want to do as far as helping the situation out?
Well, I would call on especially the people in the six counties that surround the Apalachicola River to get more involved. This is our culture. This is our home. For many of us, it's generations of our family have sustained themselves from all that the river's provided. This is the time to get in and ensure that we are able to hold on to that and preserve it for our children and grandchildren.
Thank you, sir. Thoughts from you, Georgia Ackerman.
Everybody grab your pen. You ready? www.apalachicolariverkeeper.org. Please, please, please check the information out there. Get involved. Everything you do helps us collectively make a difference and protect the river. And a shout out to the folks paddling this year, everybody that's contributed. It's just a dynamic group, and we're really excited, and we want everybody in the community to learn more.
Okay, Kim Sash, I know you're going to be running out to Publix here and hitting up some more people for contributions right after this show, right?
I want to thank everybody that's contributed to me so far. I've had lots of generous people contribute, and if anybody still wants to contribute, you can go to that website, and it's Georgia's birthday today, and
happy
so
birthday.
Please give some money in honor of her birthday, but I'll be keeping a species list and keeping everybody posted, and I'm just really excited, and I think one of the things that's most important to me about this river is that it affects us all, and this decision could affect us all, and it could be precedent setting. And I think that, the river will touch you if you go visit it, and I want people to explore it and appreciate it and apply for River Trek next year.
And for veterans like you, Doug Alderson, who have been, this will be what, number five?
Number four for the whole thing, for the complete one. But we're on a record-setting trend for our goal this year. Our goal is $40,000, and this group is very dynamic, and I think we'll exceed that. But we need more because it's not cheap to do what Dan's doing, to fly all over and speak on behalf of the river and bay. You have to go out of state. So that's not cheap, so we need to support him and the river keepers.
And particularly since most of the persuasion that you have to exercise, Dan Tonsmere, comes up north. So you got to go up there and get more of the folks in line with those in places like Georgia who already understand and appreciate what the Apalachicola means, not just to them, but also to us down here in Florida and how they're invited to always enjoy it the way we see it, too.
Absolutely. As Kim said, this is a precedent-setting issue, and it will help people all over the country to protect their systems if we can come up with a favorable decision. The reality is these decisions are going to come down to a handful of people, a couple of generals in the Corps of Engineers. They are going to have to break ranks with their traditional operations and take the Corps where Congress has directed them to be a greener organization and respect these ecosystems. The special master is one guy that is going to make a recommendation to the Supreme Court. I just want to encourage everyone, not just our River Trek people, because they are on it right now. Get the word out to everybody you know of the significance of this system and of the gravity of this decision. Try to get the word out. 90 days until everything's going to pretty much be in the can. So now's your time.
Dan Townsmere, thank you so much. Apalachicola Riverkeeper, also on the board of Riverkeeper. Mr. McClellan out there from beautiful Blountstown, and George Ackerman, Doug Alderson, and, of course, Kim Sash. Thank you all for coming in on Perspectives
today.
Thank you. Thanks, Tom.
Perspectives produced by WFSU-FM in Tallahassee. Taylor Cox and Lydell Rawls handling the technical stuff, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Next Thursday, we'll learn about some new initiatives to help folks with disabilities develop productive and enjoyable careers. We'll talk then right here on Perspectives.
Audio copies of Perspectives are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. Log on to WFSU.org for online archives and podcast. Perspectives is a production of 88.9 WFSU-FM, Tallahassee.